way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd.
Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, April the 16th, 2026, and this is episode 3,835 of the Survival Podcast, and it is a Thursday. That means it's time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. I've got a good lineup of experts for you today. I was actually worried about Tuesday that I wouldn't have enough material for today, and the piker tree yielded many falling pikers into the inbox, and I actually have a surplus of content now. So thank you to all the expert council members who got me extra content this week. I really appreciate it. I'm going to be good, and well, not next week, the week after, because next week there won't be a show. I've made a decision. I'm not even going to do rewinds next week. I am in Tennessee all week. I'm simply going to take the week off for a change. I think I need that, and I'll come back. So we're going to be all off next week. I'll put some announcement out or something on Monday about it just to remind everybody. But I did want to also remind you of something else, and that is that soon after I get back, in fact, it will be on May the 4th, we are launching the next round of the AI for Solopreneurs course. Called Become Dangerous with ChatGPT. This is a boot camp. It's a 40-day boot camp. It's run Monday through Friday. We drop the prompts and the instructions once a day into a private Telegram group. You then execute those prompts and discuss them with your fellow students. We only take 100 students per round for this. That's so that Tom and I can oversee everything and make sure everything's going the right way and people get their questions answered and everything stays manageable. This is also helping us build a crew of people who have all been through this training, who own businesses or are building businesses in the TSPC community. We have over 300 people that have already been through this process. They're all in an alumni group. Not only do you get to go through this process, some of those alum will come into your group to be like big brothers, big sisters, mentors, and help you along the way. But when it's over, you get put into their group. And you now have access to this network of entrepreneurs. It's an amazing course. Everybody that's taken it has gotten great results if they've applied it. It's $300. It is a deal at that price. A lot of work went into it. We've had very few people complain about some very nitpicky little things. Overall, the satisfaction is about 4.95 out of 5 stars, with 300 people having done far more than kick the tires on it. So the only way you're going to get into this course is go to jackslaws.com right now, fill out the form, and then you'll get some emails as we come up to May the 4th being with you where you can sign up. And that will be a Monday. It will go on sale in the morning. We'll send out an email about 15 minutes before the page goes live, and then it's a race. And if you get in, you get in. If not, you got to wait till the next round once again, which will be, the end of summer. Because it's a 40-day course, and we take weekends off for it and what have you. So if you want to be able to turn AI into me as your business consultant, using the format and the methodology that I used in my consulting days, that's what this course will do for you and so much more. So if you are not yet registered, please do, because you're not getting in if you're not registered. It's not going to happen. The last three sold out. The last one sold out a little slower because it was like right up against Christmas, but the other two went in minutes, literal minutes. All right, so with that, let's go ahead and jump on into today's subjects, and we're going to start out with an analysis of taxation. As yesterday was Tax Freedom Day for most of America, the aggregate average, yesterday was the day, or today's the day, actually. Today's the day. Yesterday was a filing deadline. It just worked out that it was one day past the filing deadline. This year, for the average American, you are no longer working for the government. Most likely. That depends on where you live. If you live in California, New York, you still are. And if you live in Texas, you haven't been for a few weeks. But all of us work a significant portion of our year just to pay taxes. Dan McAdams and Dr. Paul discuss, is this a form of modern slavery?
I talk about two things that talk about slavery, the modern-day slavery. One is the draft, because they take you up, they send you off to war, and many of them can get killed. And you know, when you think about what was going on with especially Vietnam, and also it's the income tax. The income tax, the way I see it, Daniel, is that the assumption is made in order to do this is that everything you or I earn that is ours and should be ours to keep and spend the way we think. And that is the way it was before 1913. It was your money if you earned the money.
Yeah.
So we have that, and we have that, we have our income. We still get income, but I think there's proof that it's not ours, because the way I see it, the government says we own everything. We can tax it, we can take it, we can regulate it, and the whole works. And therefore, if you can't use it, it's not yours. It's already the government. So it's a form of slavery.
Yeah.
This is modern day slavery. And the big question is who should own the income? Of course, the people who earn it should have the income. And also. This is an attack on property, too. It extends to property, too, because it's not too infrequently I say, you don't own your property.
Yeah.
You rent it. You rent it from the government.
Yeah.
And it's several levels of government participate in that. So if they can say, if you don't pay it, and they're pretty aggressive, they're bill collectors. So you pay your taxes, and once again, they really own our land. What if you want to build something on it? Well, you got to get permission. A little bit of that locally, you know, wasn't so bad. But what about the federal regulations, the environmentalists who are now seeing that they overdid it, and they're backing off a little bit from that?
Yeah, you make such a great point about the fact that you only rent your property from the government, and if you stop paying rent, you stop owning your property. A lot of Americans believe they're free, and they laugh at people who live in places like China and Cuba because they can't own property. Well, guess what? We're in the same boat. You know, we really are in the same boat. We shouldn't be too smug.
The entire objection that I have actually seen as a whole to this argument that taxation is a form of modern slavery is always exasperated, feigned outrage at the concept. Yeah, that's not an objection. Then when people do try to be logical about it, they say, but taxes pay for the services we use. And I always point out, like, if I went to your house and robbed it and stole all your money, and then I went and took some of that money and used it to repair a slide at the park your kid plays in, and your kid slides down the slide, I still stole your money. The fact that I did something useful with a small portion of it does not change the fact that I stole it from you. And when you institutionalize that system to a point where it is compulsory and someone has no right to avoid it, and then you stack on additional things that state does, as Dr. Paul pointed out, like the draft, specifically he pointed out Vietnam, I would say at all times, including the draft of peacetime. Between Korea and Vietnam, we had a draft during a lot of those years because we were simply under the force that we thought we needed to have for a standing military, that all of that is a form of slavery. If I can tell you, a young man is 19 years old, and you're trying to figure out what to do your life, and you just got a job working for a landscape company or something like that, pushing a mower around to get started in life, and you're planning a life in the future and what you're going to do, and you know what? Put that shit on hold for 3 years or 2 years or whatever. You're going to be in the military. I have taken away your liberty. I mean, it's worse than taxation. I have taken you from your home to do what I tell you to do when I tell you to do it exactly the way I tell you to do it. And feigning, oh my God, it's not slavery. Slavery's so horrible. How can you say that? Does not argue the point. I think they're spot on. I do take exception with the terminology that because you are taxed on your property, you rent your property. This is one of those things I think is where a lot of people, especially in the libertarian space, they do take it too far with the terminology. It's not rent. And if you've ever been a landlord, you are acutely aware of the fact that it's not rent. I don't even mind it so much, though, used the way that they just used it. I mind it when people who just can't figure out how to buy a house uses an excuse as to why they're not. Like, if I bought a house and I have to rent my own house, then I don't want to do that. Well, if you're my tenant, you're paying my property tax for me. It's not like I'm like, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to figure out the total cost of this rental unit, and I'm going to rent it to you, except I'm not going to include property tax in it. It is a very myopic, blind, excuse-making way to look at it. From what they're saying, I get their point. But when you tax property and income both, and you tell people they are subject to mandatory service to the state, those are all forms of modern slavery. And just because the word is triggering to you, if you happen to be that person, doesn't change it. In fact, it should make it worse, because this is the very definition of slavery. I just like to add a word to it: fractional. It's fractional slavery, to be more accurate, the taxation thing, because that's permanent. You're always subject to some form of taxation. That's always some form of a claim on your ability to earn income. Okay? It flat out is. On the draft, I would refer to it as, to be like technically accurate, indentured servitude, because it does come with a finite timeline, and it does come with certain restrictions on the owner of the indentured servant. And it has certain stipulations, where slavery is pretty permanent. You know, if you look at the traditional institution of slavery, it was always divided between slaves and full-on slave, that you're owned, your property, I can sell you, and indentured servant. Some would just point out that it's a temporary contract of slavery. Call it what you want, but historically, that's what we're looking at. But it is amazing to me that we live in a country today where people work 3, 4, 5 months a year for the government before they begin to have the ability to work for themselves, depending on where they live. Next up, let's hear from Jesse about Bitcoin and why the Iranians want it. I'll have a little short follow-up on this one.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Today I have a question from Dave. Dave asks, can Iran really collect a Bitcoin payment in seconds to let an oil tanker through the Strait of Hormuz? For those that may not have heard, Iran has been working to implement a toll system for ships transiting the Strait of Hormuz. Unsurprisingly, Iran does not want to get paid in U.S. dollars that could be frozen or seized by the U.S. government. Bitcoin makes sense because it can be transmitted electronically without the need for any financial intermediaries. This way, there are no governments or companies that can block the transmission of the funds, but it does not mean that the Bitcoin transactions are private or secret. On April 8th, a Financial Times article quoted Hamida Hosseini, a spokesperson for Iran's Oil Exporters Union, saying that vessels are given a few seconds to pay in Bitcoin once approved for transit. Most people familiar with Bitcoin think of payments as being somewhat slow, that it takes 10 minutes or more for a payment to be made, and even longer to be sure. So how can this be? When you send a Bitcoin payment, two separate things happen, and many people confuse them. The first is the broadcast. Your wallet creates the transaction, signs it with your private key, and sends it out to the Bitcoin network. This happens in seconds. Very quickly, the transaction is relayed to nodes all over the world. The second is the confirmation. This is when the transaction is added into a block by a miner. Blocks are created on average about every 10 minutes. When a block is mined on top of a block with your transaction in it, your transaction is said to have gotten a second confirmation. Each additional block mined afterward adds one more confirmation. So yes, Dave, Iran can receive Bitcoin payments in seconds, but these are unconfirmed transactions. These unconfirmed transactions are waiting in a pool with many other transactions that have been broadcast, but not yet permanently recorded. These are sometimes referred to as zero-conf transactions, short for zero confirmations. They are waiting to be confirmed. If you've ever heard the term mempool, that's what this is. This is the area of Bitcoin where all of these unconfirmed transactions are stored, pending, waiting, being added into the next block in the Bitcoin blockchain. For most standard Bitcoin transactions, you wait for at least one confirmation before considering it settled. For very large amounts, many people wait for as many as six confirmations. Six blocks happening average of 10 minutes apart means it takes about an hour to get those six confirmations. So how does a few seconds work for a payment that could be worth millions of dollars? Iran is accepting zero conf. They see the broadcast, verify the amount, the destination address, and that's good enough to issue a transit permit. Now, accepting zero conf for a large payment normally carries some risk. The concern is that someone broadcasts a payment and then replaces it with a transaction that doesn't send you the Bitcoin. There's a feature called Replace by Fee, RBF, in many Bitcoin wallets that lets the sender replace an unconfirmed transaction with a new one, paying a higher fee. So accepting a multi-million dollar payment with zero confirmations might seem foolish. But think about the context here. Iran has the ship's name, registration, cargo manifest, and the physical vessel. The shipping company is a known entity with real assets and a reputation. And of course, there's an armed patrol boat alongside it. If someone tried to reverse a toll payment to Iran and got caught, the consequences would not be a customer service complaint. You're not cheating a coffee shop. You're cheating an armed military force that controls the waterway your ship is currently sitting in. And if the transaction simply never confirmed, Iran has the same answer. The ship stays put until the payment settles. There's no appeals process. The practical risk of a double spend in that scenario is essentially zero. Not because of the technology, but because of the circumstances around it. For folks familiar with the Lightning Network, you might wonder why Iran doesn't use Lightning for faster payments. Lightning is designed for speed, but it requires allocating large amounts of Bitcoin in pre-established payment channels between the sender and the receiver, and transaction finality still depends on the underlying Bitcoin blockchain confirmations. That works well for regular trading partners, but it does not work as well for a random ship showing up at the strait for the first time. On-chain zero-conf is actually the right tool for the situation. And that's really a useful lesson for everyone. How many confirmations you need is not a purely technical question. It depends on what you're doing and what the context is. For a $5 coffee shop purchase, zero-conf is fine. No one's going to bother reversing a small dollar transaction. For a large purchase from a stranger on the internet, wait for multiple confirmations. For a multi-million dollar payment to a military force that has your ship, zero-conf works just fine, but for entirely different reasons than the coffee shop. When you understand how Bitcoin works, you know for yourself how many confirmations you need to trust the transaction that you're working with. Understanding Bitcoin is a journey. If you're already on the path, congratulations. If you haven't started yet, start now. You're not too late. This has been Jesse Markowitz with yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Keep sending your questions into Jack. I'm always looking to answer more on Bitcoin, self-hosting, and any other technology questions I can help with.
Yeah, this actually brings up an interesting thing with the old debate between Bitcoin and Bitcoin trash. Oh, did I say trash? I meant cash. I meant trash. You know how Bitcoin Cash is just like so super, uber, duper fast, but yet it uses a blockchain that's almost identical to Bitcoin's with just larger block sizes. And so it has the same rule set, it has the same mining procedure, and it takes basically the same time to clear a block. So how's that work? Well, everything Jesse just said about Bitcoin is true about any type of coin that uses a mining process as a verification method. And so when you get that little thing, when somebody sends you Bitcoin, let's say you sell something for $100 to them and they swipe your QR code and you get in your wallet an alert that says it's been initiated, that payment's coming. It's going to happen. It hasn't been confirmed yet. And so you can't send it on forward. But you, if you're selling something and you don't need the money this millisecond, you can put that away and forget about it. There's no way for that person on the other end to say, oh, I didn't mean it, bring it back, including when you're giving somebody $1 million to drive a giant ship through a strait with a bunch of oil on it. So the bigger thing I wanted to add on to this, though, is what the media has been saying about this, because once again, the media is made up of brain-dead, stupid morons that talk about things they know absolutely nothing about with the definitive confidence of an expert. I mean, peak of the Dunning-Kruger curve. So what they're all saying from Fox News to MSDNC and everywhere else, CNN, all of it. What they're all saying, well, Iran wants these payments because they're untraceable. Which is the biggest pile of bullshit, especially when you're talking about like $1 million plus payment. It's very easy to see the address that it came from, the address that it went to, and go, that's probably Iran right there. And it's easy to then trace all that Bitcoin and everywhere it goes. The traceability is there. Especially when you know where you started, right? Yes, it's hard to figure out, hey, there's some Bitcoin on an address. It's been there for 5 years. No idea who originally had it. It can be done, but it is complicated. When you know who got it and you have a good idea who sent it, tracking it from that point forward is actually really easy. So why would the media lie about this? Now, the person saying it on TV, smiling with her little blonde head dinking back and forth, or his frickin' $1,000 suit perfectly pressed, that moron probably is not in on it, and they probably believe exactly whatever's on the teleprompter, if they even retain it past their first martini after they're done in the evening with work. Okay? I'm saying the people putting it up there and saying, say this shit, they know what they're doing. The programming director, do you understand why they call it programming yet? You ever think about that? All the executives get together and decide what they're going to put on the TV or what, make a movie or whatever. They call it programming. Programming, like you program a computer. Programming, got it. Okay? So they're programming you with Bitcoin is untraceable. That way, you'll think it's untraceable. And either you'll be against it, or if you use it, you'll act like it's completely untraceable, and you'll get your ass in a sling. But what is the real reason Iran wants it? Jesse hit it. It is unstoppable, unconfiscatable. That's why. Because if you hold money in dollars in any form that's electronic, which is the only way you're going to take payment for a ship going through a strait, is electronically, especially in that volume, then those dollars can be attacked and seized. That's how the global banking system works. Russia has billions of dollars tied up right now that were in foreign banks that have been seized over the Ukraine thing. That's an example. When you send somebody Bitcoin, it can be seen. You might know who sent it, who got it, where it goes next. But you can't do one damn thing to stop it. And that is what actually puts fear in the heart of the banks. And the banks are the people who really run your world and the ones that benefit by the slavery that we just talked about with Dr. Paul. So you think your congressman really benefits from your slavery. They have an auxiliary, like an auxiliary benefit. They're getting it as a byproduct. The people that run the country are the people that control the money, and the people that control the money are the ones that benefit from your slavery. That sucks. That's why you gotta have some Bitcoin in your life. You gotta have some real estate in your life. I know they can still come at that in ways, but it's a totally different way to handle things. You should have some precious metals in your life. You should have tools, knowledge, and skills. You have to look at your capital differently in a world where anything that is just monetary capital in electronic form, including equities and stocks, can be seized at will by various entities that do not have your best interest at heart. Let's go look at something totally different, though. Medical stuff. Let's talk about something called a bone contusion, commonly also called a bone bruise, what it is and what you can do about it. And we'll hear from Doc Bones, who's been out traveling for a few weeks, so we ain't heard from him in a while.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, and co-author of the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net or altonfirstaid.com. I've talked a lot about orthopedic injuries in the past, mostly fractures you'd encounter off the grid. All problematic bone injuries do not involve breaks, however. They may cause the formation instead of what we call a bone contusion, better known as a bone bruise. What happens in a bone bruise? Bones are living tissue capable of suffering internal injury without obvious external signs. In bone bruises, the hard outer layer of the bone remains intact. It's the spongy inner bone material, called trabecular bone, that's damaged, sometimes with the accumulation of inflammatory fluid or blood deep even in the bone marrow. The superficial cover of the outer bone, known as the periosteum, may also be affected. The periosteum, if you don't know, is a thin membrane of connective tissue that acts like a protective sheath over the bone. It provides support for bone growth and repair. So that's all the anatomy I have for today, though. Bone bruises ordinarily wouldn't show up in an impressive way on x-ray like a fracture does. They are admittedly the step below an actual broken bone. Now, that doesn't mean that they aren't a big deal. The family medic in survival settings is likely to encounter them and must know how to handle it. Most but not all bone bruises affect the lower extremities, the hip, knee, thigh bone, shin, ankle, etc. But occasionally they're seen in the spine or upper extremities. Common causes are collisions, falls, twisting injuries, repetitive stress in an area, or even collateral damage from ligament or cartilage trauma in, say, maybe the knee, places like that. Close to 80% of ACL damage involves bone bruising. Bone bruises often act like a really bad soft tissue bruise, but the pain is deeper and more persistent than you would expect from a regular bruise injury. The pain is worse when bearing weight on the injured limb. You'll also see stiffness, loss of range of motion, discoloration, like a standard bruise, but not always, and swelling. Dull aches from a bone contusion last longer than a typical soft tissue bruise, sometimes taking weeks before discomfort and skin changes fade away. Some patients complain of pain well after all the visible signs disappear. In normal times, an MRI or CT scans are usually what are used to identify a bone contusion, and they're better than an X-ray. That's not an option for the survival medic in times of trouble, certainly off the grid. So how can you tell a bone bruise from a fracture, let's say? Bone bruises can hurt as much as minor fractures, but generally allow better stability, especially near joints. Some severe contusions border on what are sometimes called microfractures, especially in the trabecular bone that I described earlier. One way to identify a bone contusion versus a fracture is with two basic tools, a tuning fork and a stethoscope. Take the tuning fork, and 128 Hz is a common tuning fork to use, and strike it on a surface and then place it on the bone below the level of the fracture, the part away from the torso. Then, place a stethoscope above the level of the fracture, closer towards the torso. In a fracture, sound will be decreased compared to a contusion on intact bone. Compare it with the opposite uninjured side. Treatment is primarily conservative and focuses on protecting against further injury. For this, the classic RICE protocol is employed. Use that usually for sprains. R is for rest. Avoid weight-bearing if at all possible. I is for ice. Apply cold packs to the injured area for 20 minutes every 2 hours for the first 48 hours. Compression, that's C. Apply elastic wraps, not too tight, to decrease local swelling. Elevation, that's E. Elevate the injured limb 12 inches above the level of the heart. And stabilization, for S. Do your best to immobilize the injured area to prevent further damage. Other options include the use of over-the-counter meds like ibuprofen for pain, physical therapy to improve stiffness, and of course, rest. Food rich in calcium, protein, and vitamin D may help support the healing process. Surgical intervention, however, is rarely necessary. That's good news for the survival medic. So how long before a bone bruise heals? Recovery time from a bone bruise varies, depending on location and other factors, but typically is 1 to 3 months. But severe cases can take up to 6 months to fully heal. While often self-limiting, they require patience. Rushing recovery in your patients with a bone bruise, that can lead to a worse outcome. An ounce of prevention, of course, is worth a pound of cure. Proper protective gear while exerting activities of daily survival, that's key. Strength training and balance work to reduce fall injury risk is also important. Avoid rapid progression in exercises like weight training. Don't go up in weight too quickly. Bottom line, even if minor, bone bruises are part and parcel of the risks of trauma in survival settings. Know what to do and you'll keep it together even if everything else falls apart. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, make sure you get your family medically prepared for times of trouble by checking out our entire line of quality medical kits and individual supplies at AltonFirstAid.com. You'll be glad you did.
Well, that's good to know, and something you don't want to happen, but if it does, you certainly need to be able to deal with it. Doc is always great about that. Remember, if you have a question for Doc Bones or any of our experts, you can send them to me. Jack at thesurvivalpodcast.com, put TSPC, expert, in the subject line. Say, my question is for expert council member, fill in the blank. Don't put fill in the blank, put their name there. My question is, ask your question in a single sentence that ends in a question mark. Hit return twice. Now give me all the details you think you need. If you follow that format, the odds that you will get your question answered by an expert relatively quickly, like over the next few weeks, on air are very, very, very high. I've been doing this for 18 years. I'm a professional trying to help you out here. Follow the formula, get formulaic results like you just heard from Doc. Next up, somebody did that, and they sent a question in for Andy McCann about rucking. What is it? Is it worth doing? Does it really have any great benefits? And if you're going to do it, how should you go about that? With that in mind, here is Andy McCann.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. And my goal is to help you look good naked and become harder to kill. So my nemesis is still reading out loud. And I got an email here forwarded over from Jack from Chris from Utah. It is very well written. And let me just tell you, the answer to your questions is yes, it all matters. And good job. Keep going. But here we go. Question for Andy. Is rucking worth it? All right. I'll get into what rucking is. In a moment, basically, put a backpack on, go do something hard. Details. I am trying to figure out where rucking fits compared to CrossFit, jogging, and just regular workouts. Specifically, I'm going to answer these as I read them off because the answer is yes for all of them. Does rucking provide something unique those others don't? Yes. What matters most? Weight, distance, time? Yes, all of it. Are hills important? Or does flat ground still get it done? Yes. Does the terrain, trails versus pavement, matter much? Yes. Nutrition? Yes. So he says, my goal is practical fitness, weight loss, preparedness, and becoming harder to kill, not competition. And that's exactly what we do. So the answer to your question is yes, added in there, but the but becomes pretty big. Like you said, weight loss. Okay, right there. Yes, rucking matters, I suppose, doing something. Anything is better than nothing. But your body's the ultimate adaptation machine. So if you're going to go jog for 30 minutes every day for the rest of your life and not increase the distance, you're just going to do 30 minutes. So let's say it's you're doing the exact same 5K in the exact same 30 minutes. The return on your investment goes down dramatically as your body actually gets used to that stimulus. So the unfortunate thing, just like cocaine, if you snort it, you need more to get to the next high. If you smoke weed, you need more to get to the next high. Your body is the ultimate adaptation machine. The stimulus you give it, I'm going to stress like a tiger chasing me, your body will get used to it. So you need to find better or different stressors. So there's only so much you can push in terms of like lifting weight because there is a maximum that you can get to without outside help, drugs or whatever, right? So you want to push other stimulus to get there. Not everything is a direct relationship to muscle or cardio. It could be, hey, I'm losing weight, or it could be something changing or fixing inside of me. All right, the biggest one I'm going to throw in there is you said nutrition. Yeah, nutrition totally matters. If I was going to do anything for preparedness, I'd stop being like fat, right? I would stop eating stupid stuff. I would just eat like, I would try to get my weight down because if my weight is holding me back, then I am just a hindrance on everyone else that I'm trying to prepare for. So I would almost say nutrition is number one, but really it's the five things. They all go together. It's how you eat, sleep, move, think, and connect. And really you got to put it together in a nice little pie. Ah, pun intended. So the angle that I would take this down on preparedness is I would imagine either we're at home doing our thing on our little farm compound, whatever, in which case carrying is important, or it's a get out of dodge type of scenario. So you are going to ruck, carry things out. Now you'll probably use pavement because that's the easiest, but then again, there's more people on the pavement most likely. So there's a lot of things that come into play. If you're worried about security, then are there multiple of yous walking? Well, that's good. You know, there's security in a crowd. Or do you have an obvious threat deterrent like a shotgun or a bat with spiky bits? I don't know, something like that. But then again, if you're carrying a big backpack and you have a bat, I mean, I'm not too worried about you. Your swing's going to be off. So there's a lot of stuff that goes into play. I would say, yes, rucking matters, and I would do it. I do it. I have, actually, I'm going to give Jack a link to post to you guys from Amazon. It's a vest I use. They have it in various sizes from like 2 pounds up to like 40 pounds. I just use a 12-pound vest. It's just a little extra when I go out and jog because I have a normal route. And I don't want to speed up. I like nature. I want to be out there. So I want to make it a little bit harder in a different way. And that's where rucking comes into play. As a matter of fact, I like this vest so much. I bought all of my coaches weighted vests. I said, pick your poundage, 6, 8, 12, 16, 20, 25, 30, and I will buy it and bring it to the gym, and it'll be your Christmas present. So, I'll send this over. It's a Zealous weighted vest. Again, I do the lightish one, so 8 to 12 pounds would be my jam. So the biggest thing that you're going to get in the difference by putting weight on your back and going is a sustained effort with a continuous load. So in CrossFit, we're typically picking up a weight and putting it down. If you're just out doing jogging, there isn't, while you have the continuous strain, the extra loading is off, so you don't have that. I suppose the easiest answer is to say, hey, if you know, like, and trust Jack, he has extended that to me on the expert council, and I rock. I also do CrossFit, so I see the value of it. So I would say, again, yes, but let me keep going through your questions. It does change what you do. So if you're used to going out and jogging for 30 minutes, I probably wouldn't throw the backpack on and go out for 30 minutes unless you bought a light one, like a 6 or 8 pounder. I would first try something shorter and more manageable just to see if anything is out of whack on your own body. So just maybe half it. You could even do that twice a day, or do it half, take a break, stretch out, and then maybe do that again. But you want to see if your body is going to respond well to that. You don't know. Maybe you've got undiagnosed scoliosis and this little bit of weight is the straw on the camel's back. Pun intended. I would definitely go down the route of adding the weight and then doing a moderate pace, and then eventually start building into speed or going like aggressive uphills. I wouldn't do it all at one time. In general, for any of this stuff, if you're ever out doing a thing, hills suck. So yeah, go do them, because it's going to make you harder to kill for sure. Okay, so where I rock, I fit it into my schedule. I used to put it in my schedule. I'm at a little bit of a limbo right now. So we did a men's group at 7 a.m. over at someone else's house, and it was next to a trail, so I could throw on my little weighted vest, get on the trail, and do like an hour and a half of jogging. It was great. I loved it. I was going to be late to any of my classes at my own gym, and I don't like it when people show up late, so I was going to show up late to my own class. I also like to get everything done in the morning. Now, we've recently changed that. We're now meeting at the gym, so we meet, and then we all go to class afterwards. So I don't have a great opportunity to ruck. Now, I just went out on an adventure race. It was an Oak Mountain adventure race over in Birmingham, Alabama, where basically you have a hydration pack and a bunch of food in your back in a backpack, which is rucking, and you go out for 10 hours in the woods and do stuff and things. So I wish I had trained that a little bit more. Is it valuable? Yes. Should you do it? Yes. You probably should focus on nutrition first, as that was the second stated goal, with preparedness, which is your third, which those things going to go hand in hand, especially making you harder to kill. All right. Hope that works. Y'all take care.
So the only thing I'm going to add is why I like the concept of using a weight vest, which Andy did send a link for, and I do have in the show notes today, over an actual rucksack. And you might think, given he even got into the fact that you might have to someday throw a pack on your back and get your ass moving, why would you do that instead? Well, I will tell you a couple reasons. One, because in a lot of places you might be training, walking, etc., you stick out a lot less without a big giant pack on your back. That's one of them. But number two is, especially if you don't have any experience doing this, I'm going to tell you something that's very common to happen in the Army during basic training, and even in permanent duty stations when you would do field training exercises with long road marches and things in them. If you do not get a pack well-balanced, well-adjusted, and sitting proper on your back, it can still feel relatively comfortable initially. And as you walk, it can cause lots of issues with impinged and pinched nerves. For me, whenever I got it wrong, what would happen is about a mile and a half, 2 miles into it, I would start to feel an ache, and I'd hope there was a break where I could readjust some things and try to square it away, because if not, literally the area kind of behind the right shoulder blade in particular for me, by the time it was over with, would be throbbing with pain. And this is not like the kind of thing you're just enduring because you're learning to be tough. This is a like a neural issue that then would take several days after that to subside. This is in the military where you're being trained how to do it properly. Have an expert there as a drill sergeant or like a platoon leader or whatever, showing you how to do it, checking you, and trying to make sure you do it right. Okay? And you still have that happen. So what do you think happens to a person with no experience, no training, that just gets some random backpack and fills it up with a bunch of shit and puts it on? Yeah, where you're bearing the weight with a vest, and they're also very configurable, meaning that I can start out with, say, a 15x pound of extra load, and I can add that weight like Andy was talking about, and I can do it well distributed on my body, and I have a lot less propensity to have issues with my back, my neck, my nerves, my shoulder blades, and things like that. I think it's just for a training tool for a person that's considering the main thing they're training for is fitness. It's just a better tool. If you're actually, like, the reason the military doesn't do that is because you are actually training to carry that pack. And there's a difference in just straight fitness and training to do a thing that results in fitness. Anyway, let's go ahead and take it on. By the way, I think it's a fantastic form of exercise. I think walking is one of the best forms of exercise there is. And simply adding weight that you have to bear to walking completely changes the dynamic. Let's now talk to or hear from Matt Sersley, the Agorist tax attorney. He's going to be talking to you today about a creative type of tax deduction. What if you could buy a pool and deduct it? Can you? And I'll come back with a few additional thoughts on this one when Matt's done.
Hey, TSP. This is Matthew Sersley with Agorist Tax Advice, here to answer another listener question. So the question is a water storage system, a.k.a. an above-ground swimming pool, a reasonable homestead business asset slash deduction? More info, I am setting up an 18-foot diameter outdoor swimming pool that holds about 7,000 gallons. Given the droughts and water restrictions of recent years, this seems like a reasonable deductible expense for Schedule F, a farm. The total cost is less than $2,500, so it appears to be not subject to capitalization. Ongoing maintenance seemed to be deductible to keep the water potable. I have about 24 acres and keep 15 to 20 beef cattle at a time. This is a backup for the municipal water. My answer is, assuming it really is a backup water storage system, almost certainly. If it's a pool that you're calling a backup storage system, not so much. And this distinction really matters because when it has a business use and it is there primarily for a business purpose, it's going to usually be a deductible business expense. But if it's something you are using personally and it's just there as a backup, especially if you very rarely use it as a backup, but you're swimming in it every single day of the summer, that starts to look like a personal expense. And maybe you lose the deduction entirely. Maybe you lose it in part. But let's start off with the basics. When is something deductible as a business expense? It needs to be reasonable, ordinary, and necessary. Reasonable, $2,500 to keep your cows alive seems like a very reasonable cost. Ordinary seems like a very ordinary thing for ranchers and farmers to have backup supplies of water. Necessary, it helps you make money or avoid losing money. Again, I think you passed that test with flying colors. So if it was a simpler question, hey, if I were just going to build a water storage system to keep the livestock alive, if the main water source becomes unreliable or unavailable, then yes. The fact that it's a swimming pool is what makes me a little bit nervous. Now, above ground swimming pools tend to be very, very cheap. And so maybe this is just way cheaper than a stock tank or a purpose-built cistern or concrete reservoir. That's totally fine. But the IRS, if they ever actually do look into this, and the odds of them looking into this are very low, they're going to want to make sure this is not a personal swimming pool that you are calling part of the farm. A lot of people get tax questions wrong or they ask the wrong questions because they're focusing on the categories. And again, it's not about the categories. It's not about what do I call this. It's about how strong is the connection to the business and is there personal use mixed in. So things that I would look at to be able to tell about this, where is it located? You know, is it out in the field, half a mile away from the house, or is it 20 feet from the back door? Is there a livestock watering system that it's actually connected to? How does the water get out? Is it some sort of a permanent system, or is it just a hose you use with suction? Are you documenting the emergency use? Is it covered and maintained and treated in the way that matches livestock water storage rather than backyard recreation? And the biggest one, do you ever swim in it and can they prove it? And you might say, well, how would they know? With modern social media, all it takes is your kid posting one photo from the pool and they know. So I think this is a great idea. I love this as an idea for getting a cheap water storage system and writing it off as a business expense. If it is personal use, I would at the very minimum deduct it, not deduct all of it. I would deduct part of it. I might look at, you know, how often do we need emergency water versus how often am I using it for personal use. I'd be a lot more comfortable doing a 50-50 split at that point than a 100% split. So I think as water storage, this works great. I love this as an idea. If it gets investigated, you're going to have to answer some questions, but you have a good chance on this. Documentation is going to be helpful. Other documentation, if it really is just the price is cheaper, document those other prices. Take screenshots or take photos of, well, it would be $5,000 to get this or $7,000 to build this. So, you know, $2,500 for this makes a whole lot more sense. Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. If you have any other tax questions, please send them in to Jack, and I will get them answered for you. And please reach out to me at agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. You'll get a free download to get a whole lot of ideas for business deductions and the chance to schedule a talk with me. Thanks.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that you need to understand about how this would work, and I don't think Matt really hit on this, when you did your tax return for the year in question, you would not put on your tax return above ground pool expense. You would put something like, you would categorize that expense under farm equipment expense. Something, there would be some category of expense. When I deduct, let's say I buy a new printer this year because my old one is starting to cause me problems and headaches. And so I spend 300 and something bucks on it. I don't have to capitalize and depreciate it because it meets that threshold. I don't put on the tax return that goes to the IRS printer. It will go into a category on my income statement that says office equipment. That will go to my accountant who, when she does that piece of my tax return that determines the business income, she is going to put that into a category with other expenses that's simply to the government listed as an office expense. So there's no red alarm on an expense that size for somebody with a Schedule F showing a profit. So when he said it's very unlikely that you'll even have to explain it, he's not wrong. And the idea that therefore some random IRS agent's going to be watching your son's Instagram account, because there is an instance where something like that happened, but it was a real estate deduction in a totally different scenario, that's kind of where he's channeling when he goes there, is pretty damn low. Right? Pretty damn low. And would it even matter? I mean, if I put in a stock tank and my kids fish in it, it doesn't reduce my ability to deduct it as an expense that I put into my farm, though that's handled differently. If I go out and buy a giant stock tank, let's say an 8-foot round, 3-foot deep galvanized stock tank, and I put it there for my cows to drink out of, and it legitimately is what they drink out of, and my kids happen to swim in it, let's say we drain it, to clean it while the cattle are in a different paddock, we fill it back up and the kids have a party in it, it doesn't change what it is. It would be very difficult, though it might not be fun if you got audited and that was one of the things that they started pulling on. So I think his additions of doing things like, hey, you know, make sure there's a way to actually get that water to the animals as a backup and that infrastructure's in too, and of course deduct that. Right? Have a means by which you can say, here it is in action. I would go get myself some stock tanks, because you need them anyway, and I would pump some damn water out of there. And I would have a video of the cattle drinking the water. That would make it pretty bulletproof. But, again, I just want everybody to understand, when you hear these creative deductions coming in, Matt's answer as an attorney is, this is what they'll look at if you get audited, not so much this is what will trigger an audit. What triggers an audit is things that don't make historical sense regarding you, like something's way out of proportion for from where it was, or things that just look high for the category or classification, the ratio of expense to income. There's all sorts of things that if you have a good CPA, they should be keeping you in those margins. I had a year one year where my accountant said, all these business meals are legitimate, every one of them. Your total business meals for this tax year relative to income are high. This is an audit trigger. I would just knock $1,000 off that expense category because you're going to do really well this year anyway, and it's probably not worth it. And your odds of getting an audit go to into the toilet if we don't do this. And there's a decent chance of it if you do. That's just an example of how your accountant can help you. And sometimes if there is a way that a certain expense could both ways being legal and above board, being called a different category, you may move something out of one category into another. Again, this is a legitimate category of expense, just to balance that and reduce the potential for audit triggers. Because this is a reality. There are audits that are triggered by things you've done, and there are audits that's like winning a lottery you didn't want to win. There is a certain portion. That's why some people are like, well, we got audited, and all we are is W-2 employees, and it didn't make any sense, and it was miserable for no reason. That's like saying we got Al Capone with the tax service. It's to keep you afraid. So, you know, every year, something like 0.01% of people that file a W-2 only, or a 1099 EZ or a 1099 only. They have very little in the way of like itemized deductions or anything. It's still like 0.01% of those people automatically end up getting audited every year. So whenever you're doing something like this, you have to think about not just would I get audited, how would I explain this if I did, if I drew that short straw. And I think this one, if you do it right, pretty damn safe, especially if you can document why it's there and, you know, do you use it? That would be a question for your attorney to tell you how to answer, you know, before you had the question. Because if you go into an audit without legal counsel, you have a fool for a client. Anyway, because you're your own. Anyway, let's now dig into a kind of a whole different subject. This is John Pugliano, who is, of course, an investment manager, and he also runs the Wealth Studying podcast. And he's talking about the current state of the United States economy and our relatively soon-to-be future. And he has a message for you. Economically, don't bet against America. And I think he's on good footing here. And when I come back with my segment for the day, I'll say a little bit about this before I get into my topic.
Hey, TSP, I've been extremely busy. I've been absent for a while. I have a long list of questions. However, today, I just want to get a quick segment in and I want to comment what's going on with the general economy and the media gloom and doom story about the war in Iran. And if you can remember all the way back to last year, non-coincidentally, how a lot of this tracks the same way the gloom and doom was portrayed on Liberation Day with the reciprocal tariffs. So we're going into the seventh week of this war with Iran. Nothing's been resolved. The bottom line is Hormuz is still closed. It's choking off at least 20% of the world's global oil supply, which in any other time in history would see skyrocketing oil prices. And as you heard me say before, on a relative inflation-adjusted basis, based on prior geopolitical issues, things like the invasion of Ukraine, or the previous Gulf Wars, or even the financial crisis of 2008, on an inflation-adjusted basis, oil is still relatively inexpensive given the conflict that we're in. As I record this, oil less than $100 a barrel. Even the major markets, from the S&P 500 to the much more volatile and risky small-cap stocks making up the Russell 2000, both of these major indices are either back to where they were pre-bombing of Iran, or they're even higher. And again, I think this is very much like we saw with the tariff situation last year. That was steeper, had more of a V-shaped recovery, And this is still dragging on. And, you know, we're subject to major volatility swings based on whatever comment or tweet that Trump puts out. But even given all that, again, based on the fear mongering, all the war talk of escalation in World War III and global economic crisis, and really nothing is fundamentally wrong with the economy. Well, with the U.S. economy anyways. Not going so well for the BRICS nations. They rely heavily on oil from the Persian Gulf. The U.S. doesn't. You know, here in the U.S., yes, we've seen higher prices for gasoline. But if you're in parts of Asia right now, you're not only paying higher prices, you can't get gasoline at all. I mean, the world really hasn't seen this type of a crisis since the 1970s Arab oil embargo. And the big difference between then and now is that that primarily hit the United States. And this event isn't. And for you conspiracy-minded people out there, this is almost like payback to the Chinese for their export controls on rare earth magnets. Ah, but I digress. My message is, again, simply ignore the negativity in the media. S&P 500 corporate earnings are expected to be up a very healthy at least 10%, many analysts forecasting as high as 15% or more. And unlike in the previous couple years, this is just not all the Mag 7. The other 493 stocks in the S&P 500 are forecasted to have robust growth this year of, you know, upwards of 12%. Now listen, I can't predict the future, but I can predict that the media will blow everything out of proportion and always prey on people's fears. Just think about where we were 1 year ago besides the tariff panic. Remember DeepSeek? That was the Chinese large language model. It supposedly was better than ChatGPT and reportedly was developed for, you know, nearly nothing and using inferior chips. There was a big fear that all the hyperscalers were overspending. There was all this circular investing. Well, yeah, how has all that worked? Again, don't listen to the media narrative. Look at the scoreboard. Over the last 12 months, NVIDIA up 70%, Google up 104%, Apple and Amazon up 30%. And that doesn't even compare to the lesser known and the ancillary companies that are up and down the AI supply chain, companies like memory chip producers, Micron up over 500%, SanDisk, are you ready for this? Up over 2,800%. You heard me right. 2,800% in 12 months. Ciena is a telecommunications company specializing in fiber optics. They're up over 700%, and it's not all specifically AI companies. Old school heavy industrial companies are doing just fine too. Caterpillar, up 170%. Cummins Diesel, up 116%. The point is that if you go back over almost every historical media-driven gloom and doom story that's driven the market down, they've almost every one of them inevitably been wrong. Right now, the SaaS companies, software as a service, I'd say on average, they're down a good 50% or more. I bought into this dip a couple weeks ago, and you know what? So far, they haven't bottomed out yet, or at least it doesn't appear to. But you know what? I just don't think these big quality names are all going to go out of business simply because of AI agents. If anything, I think the SaaS companies will do what companies almost always do, and that's adjust and adapt. Now, I'm not telling you to run out and buy this dip in general or to specifically go out and buy software as a service companies. My point is to always be skeptical of anything the media says, and especially when they're talking down the U.S. economy over the long term. So, hey, as always, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Standing Podcast.
You know, I did a show about the current economic system this week, the beginning of the week, talking about money, and we'll be doing a second part of that show next week. Actually, the week after, because I'm not going to be here next week. I had a weekend coming up, and I'm flying out of here Tuesday to go up and hang out with Nicole for about a week for Living Free in Tennessee 26. And anyway, when you listen to that show and you hear how screwed up our economic system is, it's easy to then say, okay, America's screwed. But as I explained, this whole thing really started in 1913, the current form of our economic system, how money is created, how it's contracted, how it is deflated and inflated at will by the Fed, adjustable interest rates, all of it, right? And it's just like, oh, we're so screwed. And then we became more screwed in the 30s, and then we became totally screwed over by it in the 1970s. But that's been over 50 years, and 1913 is well over 100 years ago. It's up by 116 years, right? So it's not just going to dry up and blow away. Someday it may completely implode, but not anytime soon. And so the problem is all that stuff that John just said, it's so easy to say, our days were behind us, whatever. Let me put it just a totally different way. You wake up, you have to leave the house. Laying on the floor next to your bed is a shirt. It's a shirt you wore yesterday. Are you putting it on? Your answer is no. I'm going to go in my closet or my drawer and get a new shirt. Okay. All your other shirts are in the laundry. They're all thrown in a hamper together. So even the ones that weren't worn as long are now soaked in the stink of all your other clothes. You have no choice. You have no time. You have to leave now. You either pull a shirt out of the hamper or you put the one on that you wore for a few hours yesterday and took off right before bed that sat on the floor, but the dog didn't lay on it. You're probably putting that shirt on. It's the cleanest shirt that you have available. It's the least stinking shirt that you have, and you have to go out of the house for whatever reason. It's the least stinky shirt available. Okay. That's the United States economy in our global situation. Every country runs the same economic system that we do. Every single one. And that's something that I think a lot of people have a hard time understanding when they look at all the structural flaws in a system like that. The problem with that system mostly is it is a system that creates perverse incentives. And then people follow those perverse incentives. And then nothing seems to make logical sense because most people are incapable of comprehending the incentive. And they're either following it as kind of a follow the herd secondary incentive, and that's the average person. And the smart people, the truly smart people, are following the actual incentive, even if they know it doesn't really track with like historical norms. If you go back over 100 years, it doesn't make sense, but it does make sense in the system we're in. And the United States is the very best inside that system, as John said, in many, many ways. And then all the doom and gloom, and this is, I think it's actually a very dangerous thing. The orange man rage and the orange man hatred that's in the world, because what it does is, I can come up with all kinds of criticism for Trump right now. If you do it, and I don't know who you are, or if you are a major media source, I immediately write you off because your credibility is absolute ass and dog shit, because I've seen the other things you've criticized and the way you've done it and how disingenuous you've been, how much you've lied, how willfully ignorant, how willfully retarded you've been, and therefore you may be bringing legitimate criticism to the table, but nobody's listening to you that's not one of you because you've already proven yourself to be a fundamental idiot. Right? That will say anything as long as it pushes your agenda so no one will listen to you. We have a giant feedback loop in America today because of that. Right? But we're still the number one economy in the world, and we're going to be for quite some time. And we have way too much going for us not for that to be the case in so many ways. Even our form of government, as extortive as it is, as unfair as it is, it's still better than just about all the other alternatives. And if you put all the things together and you kind of like take all those variables and bring them back together and say, who has the greatest advantage in the world? Yeah, it's us, whether you want that to be the case or not. And honestly, I don't know how a person who lives in America wouldn't want that to be the case. But a lot of people apparently do not. Anyway, don't bet against America. It will come back and probably bite you squarely in the ass. So on that, I thought this actually tied really great into the question that I have for today. And this is not really a question. It's more of a statement about silver, but it gives me the opportunity to point something out that most people that try to make this point miss. And this one is from Ofer, who many of you guys know Ofer, if you've been to TSP workshops anyway, especially in the last few years. Cool guy. He says, hello, Jack. I recall my father paying 22 cents a gallon for leaded regular in 1963. The stats I can find online show 30 cents a gallon that year, so it was somewhere in that range. And you know, they're going to give you an aggregate average through the whole year, right? And we tend to remember extreme highs and extreme lows, so that's why you remember 8 cents less. In 1963, quarters and other coins were mostly silver, and had someone paid with a quarter per gallon, they would have been satisfied with its value. Today, a 1963 quarter is worth about $15. And we're practically paying a third of that per gallon of regular. I know there's many variables on both sides of that comparison, but the comparison itself makes a strong statement about our economy and our energy markets. That kind of fits in with what John's saying, is as bad as you think things are, they're really not that bad in a lot of ways. If we did inflation adjusted against silver, then gas right now is cheaper than it was in 1963. But as Ofer said, and I think this is important when you start examining economics through the through any long-term commodity lens, but specifically with the two precious metals that have a history of monetary use and backing in silver and gold, because things are different through that lens depending on what direction you're going forward or backward with. Here's what I mean. So had we never demonetized silver and gold, had they remained a cornerstone of the currency itself, my assertion is that, at least in the hands of private individuals, less silver would be, and I use this word loosely, hoarded. In other words, if your dollar, if you could take a dollar and go down to the bank and get a specific amount of silver for that dollar on demand at all times, if it was some form of fixed peg, even if we had deflated or inflated silver by doing something like making the silver quarter into the silver dollar. So a dollar got you a quarter ounce of silver, something to that effect. That would effectively cause silver to have, and this is why I tie it into the show on Monday, a high level of velocity. In other words, it would move through the economy, where right now silver pretty much is an anchor. It's either in electronics or some kind of medical device as an expendable commodity with an inelastic demand, or it is in some form of, you know, premium. It's a jewelry, or it's a coin, or it's a bar, a form of bullion that somebody is holding on to specifically because it holds value. And the only time they ever plan to do anything with it is the price goes high enough and they need the money, either exchange it for money or exchange it for goods and services. But it's kind of the last money they would ever spend. I find it's one of the great reasons to use it to build some wealth with, because the friction involved in going from silver in a box to cash in hand, which is pretty much going down to a place that buys silver, selling it, having a tax form filled out if it's over a certain amount, okay, having it come back to you and losing some of the premium because the buyer never pays the spot price and never sells at the spot price. The buyer, who's also a seller in a dealership, is going to sell a little bit over a premium over spot, and they're going to pay a little bit under it. The spot is kind of in the middle-ish of those two numbers. This all creates a psychological barrier, which means you're more likely, when you put $1,000 into silver in this quarter of the year, to 10 years from now still have that same number of ounces. It may be worth more. If it goes the wrong way, it could be worth less. But you'll have the silver because there's friction involved in moving it, and there's a certain premium in your mind about the value of it because you know what it is. That's all good, but what it means is that there's a lot less selling in the physical silver market than there is buying. And this creates a different pinch on the variability. And so since the silver's not circulating in the economy as money, and it's held more tightly because of that, again, when you spend a $20 bill, you're not spending, you know, 20 ounces of silver or an ounce of silver or a 20th of an ounce. You're not spending any silver at all. There's no connection in the mind anymore between the currency and precious metal. Neither gold nor silver. So they float as a separate commodity, and they are not a direct analog to the actual expense in society today. What I'm saying is, if silver remained the primary backer of low denomination notes in this country, ones and fives, maybe even tens, right? We had $10, we had $5 gold pieces. Be a little more pragmatic. Let's say that, you know, $100 bills were backed by a certain amount of gold, and 50s, 20s, 10s, 5s, and 1s were backed by a certain amount of silver. And that was a fixed peg, and it stayed that way. Then people would view silver and gold differently, because a paper note in their mind would be equal to physical metal in ounces or grams relative. And so it would flow. And so what happens when that flow stops? When Gresham's Law kicked in on the coinage and everybody hoarded the silver, in the 80s we would still routinely find silver coins in change we were handed back. When you were a little kid and you learned that trick, when the person behind the counter at the convenience store and you bought a 25-cent pack of gum and they handed you 75 cents, three quarters, if one of them was silver, when it hit your hand, there was a different sound to the way the metal collided, and you knew instantly, I got one, right? That was over 20 years after they took the silver out of the coins, you were still finding them. Today, if you find one out of a couple $100 worth of silver change, you know, dimes and quarters, then you're lucky. It is unusual to find it today. I'm not saying you can't, it's unusual. And that's why those numbers do not correlate. You can't legitimately say, actually, gas isn't that expensive because silver is worth X dollars. And inflation on the dollars means that, no. It doesn't work. And I don't think Ofer was saying that. I think it was a really interesting point, and that's why I talked about it today. And it shows you more about how illogical the economic system that we've built is, that it detethered itself from the most honest money we've ever had until Bitcoin. Because monetary units backed by silver and gold, before they were fiddled around with, when it was a very simple thing, so many grams or ounces of gold, so many ounces of silver, and this is what we use as money, is a very honest form of money, because silver is silver and gold is gold. If you actually had true silver and gold-backed money, the country issuing it would be irrelevant. If they were, and I'm going like into total fantasy land with all money is coinage, right? So all money is silver dimes and silver quarters and silver 50-cent pieces and silver dollars, and a certain number of silver dollars are fungible into one gold coin, and then so many of those gold coins into a larger gold coin. If that was it, you could put anybody's face on it, anybody's message on it, and if you knew that everybody was actually putting the same amount into the coinage, you wouldn't care when you're up in, you know, upstate New York and you end up with a Canadian quarter. You don't want that now, unless it's just a quarter and I'll give it to the kids, right? But in the end, you don't want, like, no company wants that. Like, they watch for that up there because it happens, right? But if they were both made of 90% silver, no one would care. And that shows you actually the problem that we live in, and why the incentives have been perverted, and why the results of the system are perversion. And I don't mean like necessarily the weird sex stuff, like the word is usually meant for. What I mean is, like, this is normal, sane behavior, and this behavior is perverted from what's normal. It's perverted from the acceptable behavior of the mean. We have perverse behavior because we have perverse incentives. We have dishonest behavior because we have dishonest money. Anyway, with that, I've wrapped up. Again, you will not hear from me in a long format podcast anyway next week. I may put out some material for you, but I got a lot of stuff to do around here to make sure everything is set for Dorothy while I'm gone. And I'm going to have a great week up there. I know I'm going to be seeing about, I guess, you know, 50 of y'all is students, but with presenters and all, her head count's more like mine, 75 to 80 people on site. It should be a great week, and I should come back really fired up, guys. I've been working on some stuff that I'm really excited to share with you, but you'll have to hold on for a week. When I get back, we'll talk about some of it. And remember, get registered for the Get Dangerous with ChatGPT Solopreneur course. You can do that at jackslaws.com, jackslaws.com. If you do not register for it, I promise you, the fourth may be with you, but you will not be with us. You will not get in the class. Take care, guys. I'll catch you a week from now. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have